Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Gregory Maguire, the author of the novel Wicked, in 2005 talked about how he named his protagonist Elphaba's Book of Spells. It was the book that would guide her to her powers that eventually would lead her to the role as the Wicked Witch of the West. But the source for the name of the book was complicated. It is called the Grimmery. Maguire said that he wanted to associate it with the Brothers Grimm, but also echo the archaic word grammary and its historical connection to the Scottish word glamour, which means the casting of a spell over the eyes of a spectator. Coming up, we're going to explore more about the word and its relationship to witches and the relationship of both to American culture and history. Joining us now to discuss her role as Elphaba in the musical Wicked, which is now at the Ohio Theater through June 23rd, is Allison Luff. Her original Broadway credits include Scandalous and Ghost, the musical. Allison was also part of the Broadway and national tour companies of Mamma Mia. Welcome to the show, Allison.
Hello.
Congratulations on this role. It's brilliant.
Thank you.
Most of us who grew up watching The Wizard of Oz on television in my generation could think of no one they would rather not be more than the Wicked Witch of the West. And I was remembering, if you remember the first time you saw the movie and then Wicked and what your impression was of Elphaba in terms of that.
Yeah, well, actually, that was the first professional play I ever did was Wizard of Oz. And
oh,
I was
really?
Dorothy. Yes. So I definitely watched the movie a lot and had my opinions of the Wicked Witch of the West. And then when I saw Wicked for the first time, I thought I had to play that role. I had to play it because the way that we perceive her is so different than she actually is. And, you know, people think that she's this person with this long nose and these warts all over her face, but really, the movie The Wizard of Oz is only through the eyes of the spectators and what people perceived her to be. And it's not actually who she is. And so Wicked explores who she is from birth to, you know, who she is when she passes away.
We don't want to have a spoiler in there. My guest is Allison Luff. She is a star of Wicked. She plays the character Elphaba. If you have a question or comment for her, we're talking to her for the next few minutes. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. In the end of the story Wicked on stage, it doesn't necessarily come through in the book Wicked. I read the novel, which was a fantastic book. But everything about her is enchanting, from her power to her gown to her voice. When you took on the role, how did you consider the transition from sort of the downtrodden schoolgirl to this really powerful woman?
Well, I mean, I think that the age that she starts off has a lot to do with it. She starts off around 18, and I think that we all, when we hit that age, we learn things about ourselves and we experience love for the first time, or we experience, you know, feelings of... Teenagers have it hard. People that, you know, as adults, we think life is really hard, and we forget that, you know, even though these teenage problems are just minute, they're still extremely effective on how you, you know, grow up and how you feel. So, you know, when I started the show, I just was thinking that when you're 18, everything is a really, really big deal. And in her life, she has a huge amount of responsibility for who she actually is. She takes care of her sister. She grew up with one parent. Didn't particularly, you know, treat her very well. And so she deals with humor to get through everything. And I actually, that's kind of my go-to source as well. And then it really just explores the, you know, the transition to womanhood. And that's kind of what I focused on. I tried not to focus on the specifics of the show, but more how to make her into a real person. And everybody has this time where they transition into a woman, and that time happens during Defying Gravity and what she learned through her best friend, who, I mean, that won't spoil it, I guess.
No,
Glinda.
It's Glinda.
You know, and so that's the main thing that I focused on, and how we have these quirks, and, you know, when we're younger, and they turn into something that, you know, makes you more beautiful, which is how she is in Act Two.
My guest once again, Alison Luff. She plays Elphaba in the Broadway musical Wicked, which is at the Ohio Theater now through June 23rd. For more information on that, we'll have a link for you to Kappa at WOSU.org/allsides. Were you familiar with Gregory Maguire's explanation for how he named Elphaba's book of spells, A Grimoire, and its relationship to the word glamour?
I was not. I actually didn't read the book, and after I got the role of Elphaba, and I was originally thinking, oh, I'm going to go back and watch the movie, and then I decided I wasn't going to do that either, and I was just going to take it from Winnie Holzman's and, you know, Stephen Schwartz's book and just go from there and focus on that. So I actually didn't know that. I learned something new today as well.
Do you feel glamorous in your role?
I do.
Isn't that?
I do, yeah. And so many actresses who I know that have played the role before me, they told me, they said, you're going to end up feeling more beautiful and green than you do in real life, because you're going to come off stage and throughout the day you're going to have a green tint to your skin and you have green left in your hair. And then whenever you, you know, go on stage, they try to make you so beautiful in this green. And I do. I feel very glamorous. And then I kind of forget what I look like and I catch a look in the mirror and I'm like, oh, I look a little weird.
It becomes more of an exotic type of look than anything.
Definitely,
that's
yeah.
unattractive.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting thing. It's easy to watch Glinda at first, or Galinda at the beginning,
right,
and turns into Glinda, changes her name, and see her pretty clothes and her shoes. Her hair and her makeup are so stereotypically mm-hmm. glamorous. Someone might say, if you had a, you know, a magazine cover of Glinda and a magazine cover of Elphaba, you know, you would have, one would, of course, Glinda would be
right.
the glamour queen, right?
Of course.
How do the costumes help you achieve that air of power and glamour as you, you know, befitting Elphaba?
Well, I mean, the second act dress is absolutely, it's stunning. It really is. And, you know, Elphaba's costumes, more, you know, more than Glinda's, actually, are more my style anyways. And I'm black
goth,
is slimming.
A little gothy,
you know.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So I feel really skinny. and it actually is supposed to be, the Act Two dress is so gorgeous. And if you look close, it looks kind of just black from the audience. But when you look close, it's made of just thousands and thousands of pieces of material. And it's extremely heavy. It's something like 12 pounds or something. And apparently it's supposed to be kind of a version of the dress that she ended Act One in, and that she's always been on the run, so she just had to keep patching it up and patching it up, and it ended up being this gorgeous, long, you know, ragged gown, but
with some glitter.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's got beading, and the way that I see it is that she was on the run for those years, and she was just kind of having to, oh, she got a hole here, she had to sew it up. You know, she took materials from everywhere and just kind of sewed this costume. I mean, and I think that she probably retained a little bit of glamour knowledge from her best friend, you know.
That Glinda would approve.
Exactly.
At the end of Act One, Glinda tells Elphaba not to be afraid, and she says, I'm not. And that is when I feel the glamour and the power.
Mm-hmm.
You said that, did you say that you kind of felt it at the end of Act One?
Well, that moment is the moment that I'm glad that came across that way. That is the moment that she decides that she's not going to be afraid, and that, you know, she can choose to do something that isn't, you know, that her head is telling her, well, that's the right thing to do. I mean, everybody, you know, that's the easy way. Or she can go with her gut, which I think is, I mean, it's something that I struggle with as a young adult right now in my life. I'm always trying to tell myself to go with your heart and go with your gut. And that's what she does in that moment. And I appreciate that so much from her. And then really there's a, throughout that entire song, from the moment she says, I'm not afraid, you know, I can choose to do this, or I can, but I don't want it anymore. If it's going to be like this, I don't want it. And that is the moment that she starts to transition into womanhood. And there is a specific, you know, moment in the song after she's been given the cape, because she's, you know, trembling and She has the broom at this point. She has the hat that when she kind of stands up, there's like this phoenix moment, I think. And the music is so beautifully written at that point that, and it's right before she goes and flies off. There's just this like phoenix moment where she decides she's going to go. Her best friend already told her she's not going. So she's made this decision to go alone, and she doesn't know when she can come back or if she could ever come back or if she'll make it out alive. So that is the moment, I think, that, yeah, she really evolves into who we see her, who we then learn who she is or who how people perceive her.
Her relationship with Glinda is probably the most it's funny because when I look back at The Wizard of Oz, obviously they have a relationship.
Right.
And you always do wonder, how do they know about it? How can Glinda go, oh, tut, 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 to mm-hmm. this horrible witch and be so comfortable around her? And it's amazing, you know, that they're how fulfilling the backstory is
right.
on that. And that relationship with Glinda is so important to who Elphaba is.
Yeah, it is.
Surprisingly.
It's really, really cool. And it kind of makes you think around, you know, in your own life, what relationships do I not know about? And it makes you always, you know, remember that you don't know everything. And, you know, through propaganda and through rumors, we're forced to believe these certain things. But we don't really know what's going on with two people unless we're one of those people.
During intermission, there's a big makeup change.
Mm-hmm.
Your eyebrows are more arched. Your lashes lashier.
Right.
What else changes glam you up? What are they? And of course, the dress.
Yeah, I at that moment I have. Let's see, Act Two, or during intermission, I'm in full makeup change. I change wigs. I change.
Your hair gets longer.
Well, it's actually the same wig, but it's. In Act One, it's braided, and so it's got the wave, and it's bunned up, and I sweat a lot, so it gets sweaty. And then Act Two is just kind of a fresh version of that, but it's straighter, and it's in the bun, and it's just a little bit more glamorous looking, I suppose. And, yeah, Christina is our makeup artist, and she does the makeup for Act Two. She does the makeup for all of it, and she's ridiculously talented. And so, yeah, she kind of gives me a smoky eye. She changes my lipstick from being... The Act One makeup design is supposed to be very just natural. It's what...
Schoolgirl.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
She kind of contours my face, and it's supposed to look like I'm not really wearing makeup. And then Act Two is, you know, she contours my face a lot more. She changes my lips to black and kind of brings those out and does this gorgeous smoky eye. And I think that's about it, the only transition. And she touches up all my green because, you know, it comes off after a while.
I think it's interesting that the one thing we haven't, the relationship we haven't really talked about is the one with the male character.
Fiero.
Yeah, Fiero. Because that's not where I see Elphaba getting her glamour and her power from, interestingly.
That's good.
He's helpful.
Yeah.
And they love each other, but that's not where her power comes from. It's much more of a girl thing.
Yeah, it's her power comes from, she's an activist. Her power comes from helping others. And I think that if Fiero brings out any power, it's the fact that she helped him see that he's more than what everybody else perceives him to be. If he brings out her power at all, I think that that's where it comes out from. I think that she's not even fazed by him, really, in the entire Act One. She sees that she's attracted to him, but it's almost, I mean, it doesn't even get to that point. You know, she knows that that's Glinda's boyfriend, and she just realizes that she's feeling something different. I don't think she really holds him really responsible for that. And one thing that the play is so awesome about is that they really want us to focus on this love triangle between the three of us and how I didn't steal her boyfriend or I didn't, you know, he did love her and he did love me. And that happens sometimes. You happen to love two people and then he has to go with his gut. Who is he going to choose? Who's going to make him a better person and a stronger person? And But yeah, I agree with you. I don't think she gets her power from, you know, when he chooses her. I think that her power comes from helping others and, you know, helping herself and learning that she's self-sufficient and independent and resilient.
Well, Alison Luft, thanks so much for talking about your character today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Alison Luft, she plays Elphaba in Wicked. It is at Ohio Theater through June 23rd. So check that out. We'll have a link for you at WOSU.org/allsides. And best wishes for every success going forward.
Thank you. Thanks, Sam.
Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation about the idea of glamour, its relationship to the occult and magic and so forth. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Thurber House, presenting best-selling author Steve Barry. Barry will read from his new Cotton Malone historical thriller, The King's Deception. The former trial attorney turned suspense writer will be at the Columbus Museum of Art Monday, June 17th. Tickets and more at thurberhouse.org.
The father of the 401k grew up in a household that wasn't so much buying as it was saving. Spent most of his adult life planning for other people's retirements. But it turns out in today's consumer economy, he doesn't think that's working out all that well.
Hey, I'd blow up the existing structure and start over.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, saving. Next time on Consumed, Marketplace from APN.
This afternoon at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. WOSU News Director Mike Thompson and his panel talk about the top local stories of the week. Watch Columbus on the Record Friday nights at 8:30 on WOSU-TV.
Welcome back, not to Bewitched, but All Sides with Ann Fisher. The connection between witches and glamour is not just something we made up. Gregory Maguire, the author of Wicked, to explain why he called Elphaba's book A Spell of Spells, a grimoire, referenced the archaic work grammary, occult learning, magic, and so on, making the connection between that and the Scottish word glamour, which means the casting of a spell over the eyes of a spectator. Joining us now to discuss glamour is Virginia Pastorell. She is a columnist at Bloomberg View who has written extensively on the subject, gave a TED Talk on the topic a few years ago, and is the author of a forthcoming book entitled The Power of Glamour. Virginia, it is Pastorell?
Pastorell.
Pastorell. Thank you. Your next book is due in November. Thanks for joining us today.
Great. I'm very happy to be with you.
You were kind enough to share the first few chapters of the book with us in which you recall the history of the word glamour and how that speaks to its nature. Tell us about what we know about glamour.
Well, the word glamour was originally a Scottish word. Scottish was actually a separate language from English. But, of course, Scotland became part of Great Britain, and the word moved from Scottish into English, and particularly Sir Walter Scott popularized it in the early 19th century. And as you suggested in your lead-in, it originally meant a literal magic spell, a glamour. You cast a glamour on someone, or you cast glamour on someone, and it made them see things that weren't really there. And generally, it has, when you see it used in literature, it's generally a sense of things looking better than whatever's really there. So that's how it originally started. And I'm actually reading the proof pages of my book right now. And that reminds me of a way that Sir Walter Scott used the word glamour in his diaries. He was reading proof pages of his books, and he said, "It seems like there's a glamour about me that makes me see, you know, dates that aren't there. It makes me read things the way they should be instead of the way they actually are on the page, so overlooking the errors." So it started out with this idea of a glamour was a magic spell that made you see things that weren't there. Then in the 19th century, it started to take on a more metaphorical sense. And so, for example, in Jane Eyre, Jane Eyre says that the mansion is splendid, and Rochester says, no, the glamour of inexperience is on you, and you see things that things look better to you. You don't see the rot in it. And then it gradually becomes more and more metaphorical over time. And there's still, if you ever watch True Blood, for example, you will hear it used in a play on the magical sense. But there's always this idea of an illusion in glamour, and even in its metaphorical sense.
My guest is Virginia Pastrell. She's a columnist at Bloomberg View and the author of the forthcoming book, The Power of Glamour. You can see her TED Talk on glamour. We'll put a link on our website at WOSU.org/allside so you can check that out. What do we think of popularly in our culture as glamour now?
Well, this is a very interesting question. And something that I deal with a lot in my book. When we think of glamour, we tend to think of movie stars and the red carpet and glamorous dresses. We're very influenced by the way the word glamour was used in the 1930s around Hollywood. But once you start to dig into it and you think about what do you find glamorous, then you start to see that there are many things that are glamorous to different audiences. And you start with something like the glamour of travel or specific destinations that becomes sort of a very obvious form of glamour. But there are many other forms. There's the glamour of technology. I write in the book, I have these sort of sidebars called icons. I have one about the glamour of wirelessness, you know, trying to escape all the things that tie us down and how that has shaped everything from the fact that you don't see any lamps with cords in a Crate and Barrel catalog to the desire to have computing more and more, you know, in the cloud, or they, you know, fewer and fewer wires connecting us. One of the oldest forms of glamour and one of the earliest uses of the term the way we use it today is actually military glamour, which is not something people tend to think of when they think of glamour. But the glamour of battle was a common term in the 19th century, and up until World War One, military glamour and the glamour of battle was a positive term. Then after World War One, it became a negative term. And so the idea was the notion is that there tends to develop glamour around warfare, and we need to take that glamour away so that we don't get sucked into wars. So that's another thing. And you still see glamour used, not always, but some in military recruiting ads. There's a glamour of camaraderie and importance and significance and glory and all of that in the military context.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest once again is Virginia Pastrell. She's a columnist at Bloomberg View and the author of the forthcoming book, The Power of Glamour. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Is glamour then, Virginia, a totally positive word necessarily?
I believe that glamour is neither positive nor negative per se. It always contains an element of illusion. So you have to be careful with glamour. But it can be very positive depending on how you use it. It can be very negative. A lot of it has to do with two things. One is, what is being glamorized? Is it something that's positive or negative or neutral? And the other is, how do you use it in your life? So if you know, I'm of a certain age. I'm 53. I'm a journalist. I know people who are my age and a little older who became journalists because of the very glamorous portrayal of journalists in All the President's Men.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think that that is, and of course journalists are often portrayed in various glamorous ways in popular culture.
Lois
if
Lane,
you think
blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, if
yeah.
you think that's literally what the life is like, you're going to be disappointed.
Yep.
But it might point, and more recently there was a huge amount of glamour around forensic science. There was a CSI effect. You know, people get drawn into careers often because of some sort of glamorous media portrayal. If they think it's going to be exactly like that, it can be very negative. But if it points you on a path towards something that becomes satisfying, it can be positive.
I know you haven't seen Wicked, the musical, but I would imagine you saw, given your age, which is a little younger than me, the Wizard of Oz growing up. I mean,
yes, everyone's seen The Wizard of Oz, and I was obsessed with it as a child.
I was completely obsessed with it, but I always ran away when the monkeys started flying out of the castle. But I was very frightened of the monkeys. But as well as The Wicked Witch of the West. And do you see the glamour association in when it comes to witches?
Well, I love that you played the Bewitched song
right.
leading into this
right.
because of two things. First of all, it's about witches. But the other thing, what is the show about? It's also about advertising, which is...
that's right. He's an advertising...
I had never thought of that, but it, which is, of course, one of the ways that glamour is used. And I think, in a way, the Bewitched, that the idea that you can do things instantly, and that sort of, you know, your wish is my command. That's more I Dream of Jeannie.
Yes.
There was a whole thing.
Another one, yeah.
But this idea of grace and effortlessness and things just happening the way you want them to happen without all the complications in life. And, of course, then the complications happen, and that's why you get a sitcom or whatever, drama. But that is a big part of glamour, and I think that in our when we have a modern positive idea of witchcraft or witches, and it's a glamorous idea, if you will, it's very much around that. It's around the idea that you know you have this kind of power to get things done in a way that is not costly and difficult and full of effort the way getting things done in the real world is.
Before we let Virginia Postrel go, I wanted to introduce to the conversation Mitch Horowitz. He's vice president and editor-in-chief at Tarcher Penguin. It's the division of Penguin Books dedicated to metaphysical literature, and he's the author of Occult America. He's been on our show a couple times now. Welcome back to the show, Mitch.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So can you chime in here on the glamour connection to The Witch?
Absolutely. You know, I was thrilled to hear Virginia's point that journalists of a certain generation all grew up on All the President's Men. That was the movie and the book that introduced the idea of journalism as a glamorous profession to countless men and women. A similar thing has been occurring around witchcraft. There's a generation of people in our country in their 20s who have literally never known a time when the most popular literature of adolescence didn't feature these very attractive, friendly, appealing witches and wizards. And that's, of course, the Harry Potter series of books. We all understand the impact of Harry Potter, and it's been felt across the Western world. But we actually have a cohort in our country right now who has never known its absence. And so for them, the idea that witchcraft has a glamour, an appeal, a friendliness is entirely natural. And that has something to do, I think, with why we're seeing this boom in popularity right now.
Virginia Postrel, that's an interesting thing. You know, it's funny for all my thoughts about this show. there it was right in front of me. Talk about Forest Through the Trees is the Harry Potter series.
Well, another thing about the Harry, I would say another thing that turns out to be glamorous in Harry Potter is not just the occult, but it's this idea of this school. And I remember that it was they weren't sure that the books would do well in America because there's a whole literature around this kind of school in Britain that goes back. I mean, George Orwell wrote about these books for boys that were around this sort of this idea of the school and the camaraderie and the traditions and the, all of that. And that's a very sort of glamorous portrayal of a certain environment, too, over and above the fact that it's specifically about witches and wizards.
And, you know, it's worth noting that this popularity of witchcraft as a source of spiritual experimentation or as a religious commitment is found not just among the young, but I've been writing recently about the many thousands of people in the U.S. military who openly declare themselves Wiccans or neo-pagans. And in 2007, the Department of Veterans Affairs was compelled by two joint lawsuits, actually, to permit service members and veterans to claim the use of a pentagram on their military tombstones and other military insignias. So if you go to the VA website today, you can find about 38 or 40 different religious symbols. One of them is the pentagram. Wicca, or witchcraft, or paganism, is a formally recognized religion in the U.S. military today. There's a very good passage about it, actually one of the best I've ever read, in the U.S. Army Chaplain's Handbook. It's very clear in explaining this isn't Satanism, this isn't demon worship, there's nothing specifically malevolent about this. If you want to read a coherent and persuasive piece of writing about the seriousness of Wicca as a religious path today, go to the U.S. Army Chaplain's Handbook. It's one of the best sources I've found. So, you know, there are different generations since the 1950s in the West who have claimed witchcraft as a veritable religious commitment. And we're seeing that among all age groups.
Well, right now I want to say thanks to Virginia Postrel for joining us today. Thank you so much for joining the conversation, Virginia.
Thank you.
Virginia is a columnist at Bloomberg View and the author of the forthcoming book, The Power of Glamour. Still with us when we return, Mitch Horowitz, author of the book Occult America. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Carl Hiaasen. His new novel, Bad Monkey, begins with a floating body part discovered in the bay by tourists fishing. The characters include a former detective demoted to roach patrol, inspecting restaurant kitchens, and a monkey who got fired from the set of the Pirates of the Caribbean. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from TEDx Columbus, hosting two upcoming events, an open viewing of the TED Global Conference on June 13th at Gateway Film Center, and on June 19th, it's the official auditions for presenters at the 5th TEDx Columbus Conference this fall. Details at TEDxColumbus.com.
The WOSU Public Media Member Card Benefit of the Month for June is the Wexner Center for the Arts. Enjoy two-for-one admission to the galleries all month long. Support 89.7 NPR News at the $85 level and receive your member card. Just visit WOSU.org. And thank you for supporting 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This hour, we've been discussing the idea of glamour and its relationship to the occult and magic appeal of witches in our culture. Our inspiration, of course, is Wicked. It is at the Ohio Theater through June 23rd. For more information, you can check out the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Still with us is Mitch Horowitz. He's vice president and editor-in-chief at Tarcher Penguin, the division of Penguin Books dedicated to metaphysical literature, and he's the author of Occult America. His new book, One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life, is forthcoming from Crown in January 2014. Once again, Mitch, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
How did the witch culture emerge in America, the culture that brought us to the Salem witch trial era?
Well, the Salem witch trial era, of course, goes back to the early 1690s in this country, and it was a time of tremendous brutality. There were probably about 40 people, ultimately, who were put to death in or around the town of Salem, Massachusetts, between 1692 and 1694. Tragic as it was, the extraordinary thing about it is it did not continue. There was a witch craze that swept across Europe from roughly the Middle Ages through late in the Enlightenment era. The nation of Switzerland had its last witch trial in 1782. I mean, this was the age of democratic revolution. Western nations were not supposed to be having witch trials that late in the Enlightenment. But that just gives you an idea of the centuries that the witch craze extended across Europe. The remarkable thing about Salem, tragic as it was, is that it was limited in our country. It did not continue. In a certain sense, America was always seen, even in its colonial period, as a kind of safe harbor for people with alternative or radical religious beliefs. That didn't mean they weren't occasionally harassed. That didn't mean they weren't occasionally in physical jeopardy, but nothing like the European witch craze transpired in this country. Nothing like it. And what really brought witchcraft into the modern contemporary culture were developments in the early 1950s in Great Britain. In Great Britain, as late as 1951, there were still laws on the books against the practice of witchcraft and spellcasting and seances. These were a carryover from the days of the witch craze. It's baffling to realize that these things were on the books as late as the early 1950s. Britain, in 51, repealed what was called the Witchcraft Act. It repealed the last vestige of the days of the witch craze. Within a couple of years of that time, there was a folklorist named Gerald Gardner who wrote a book called Witchcraft Today in 1954, and Gardner hypothesized that the ancient nature beliefs that had been characterized as Wicca or witchcraft in Europe were still being practiced, that a kind of surviving vestige of the old nature-based religion still persisted in Great Britain. That book traveled to America. It greatly inspired people, and that's really where a kind of modern witchcraft revival got its start.
Going back to the Salem era, what sort of women were singled out of the 40 that were singled out? I'm sure there were more than that. There were just 40 that were put to death.
Fatalities.
What was it about them that attracted that kind of negative attention?
It was men and women, ultimately, who were killed, although it started with suspicion over a local woman who was an Afro-Caribbean slave who was thought to have been practicing spellcasting with some of the village girls. The great likelihood is that this woman, whose name was Tituba, was practicing some variant of the Afro-Caribbean religion that is called voodoo, which is a proper religion, and it combines elements of African tribal magic, some elements of Christianity, some elements of Catholicism. She was probably engaged in some kind of practices that were a synthesis of African, West African, Central African tribal beliefs, some aspects of New World Christianity, and people characterized it as witchcraft or demonology. Things were very, very tough in that part of Massachusetts in the winter season of 1692. Crops had failed. There were people abandoning villages. Villages that had once been thriving were uprooted. People migrated out of them because of crop failures and agricultural problems. It was a very tough winter. People were frightened. They were in a state of rage, and they turned upon the unfamiliar. And so it began with their persecution of this Afro-Caribbean slave and some young women who were thought to be under her spell. And it expanded. Most of the targets were women, but there were some men as well.
And what kind of women? Would they be independent women, beautiful women who might have been alluring? Was it people they were jealous of? What would they do?
It was viral. You know, it was viral. We're seeing the same, you know, it could be all kinds of people. You know, anybody who had a local grudge or gripe against somebody would start throwing a stone, and the mob mentality took over. It was mob psychology. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we're seeing the same thing today in certain parts of Africa. Several months ago, there was a woman in Papua New Guinea who was brutally killed and burned to death by a mob on charges of witchcraft. Again, it's that same kind of mob psychology, mob mentality. Something goes wrong in a village. There's a local dispute. People are fighting. And an accusation gets thrown around, and people seem to want to believe the worst thing that they hear because it's an opportunity to vent rage. And it can befall anyone. You know, anybody who finds themselves unfortunately singled out in a situation where there's high stress, very little civic order, and a mob mentality can be rendered a victim in this way. So we're seeing events from time to time in Africa that mirror what actually went on in Salem. The rise in popularity of witchcraft is limited to the Western world. Outside the Western world, people who get called that name can still find themselves very much in danger.
Going back to Gerald Gardner and his book that you wrote was responsible for a revival or reinvention of witchcraft following World War II. And the 1954 book that he wrote in 1954, he called their members Wicca, an old English term for wise or clever folk.
Right.
You also talk about the an aspect of Wicca, and that it is sexually free females and female affirming.
Yes, you know, Gardner, as he wrote about it in Witchcraft Today, depicted and viewed and understood Wicca as a religion that was female positive, female led. There was a very sexual aspect to it, as ceremonies and rites and rituals were often conducted in the nude. Gardner, in addition to his many interests in Eastern folklore and the retention of ancient nature traditions, was also a nudist, so this fit very well.
What do you know?
into his point of view. And, you know, we weren't quite on the cusp of the 1960s yet, but it was a message that people were ready for, the idea of an environmentally concerned, female-led, female-positive, and subtly sexual religious tradition, at least as depicted in the works of Gerald Gardner, had great appeal. It was also controversial. There were many people who felt that Gardner was inventing this idea that any retention of the ancient nature practices had survived in Great Britain. This was a subject of scholarly debate for decades and remains so. Many scholars dispute the fact that pre-Christian beliefs in any coherent way, any real thread of lineage could have survived. That's a debate that's never really been settled. We have similar debates in this country. We have religious practices in this country. There are practices that come out of the African-American slave experience that are grouped under the name hoodoo with an H. Similar debate played out in this country. Were they a real retention of tribal practices from Africa? Were they new? The truth is, these arguments always crisscross throughout different historical faiths. Religions borrow from one another. There's no pure form of one religion or another. People tend to adapt and readapt beliefs that they encounter. So usually religions tend to be a mixture of the old and the new. And I think that's probably the case with Wicca.
Lisa in Linworth, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Hi, yes. I've called before. I'll keep it quick because I think I'm out of minutes almost. I actually visited Salem, Massachusetts. I rode there by like a tour bus, just one of the day trippers. And I returned on the train, from the train that actually had to be stationed in the town. And other than being really like a weekend cottage getaway place, I actually saw the wooden plank that was allegedly from the jail that housed the people who were at least accused of the practice of witchcraft. And as a kid, my whole reference was the silly, inane comedy of Bewitched, okay?
Okay.
And I apologize to people who practice Wicca. I fully appreciate it much more as nature worship. But I guess, and it's because I'm well past 20, when I hear the word witch, certainly as it applies to women, and I'm so jones to see Wicked, I think it still has a connotation culturally of someone who is manipulative, not necessarily glamorous. Certainly, if you're wealthy, you can be perceived of as glamorous if you give off that vibe.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wonder, and I don't want to derail the whole conversation, how it could sort of play into the mean girl effect.
Well, I do want to talk to Mitch about that connection of glamour with witches and how where in our culture did it turn from this glamour reference going back to, you know, Sir Walter Raleigh and emerge as something really pejorative like the Wicked Witch of the West.
Right, right. Well, you know, to tie all the strands of our discussion together, I should mention, apropos of Bewitched, there were two episodes of Bewitched that were filmed in Salem, Massachusetts in the 1960s, and this was considered a great tourism boom for the town of Salem, which is a wonderful town. And in the local hotel in the town square, they have large black and white photographs of Elizabeth Montgomery and other cast members of Bewitched that commemorate when the show was filmed there, just to bring everything back together. Even as the caller rightly said, even today in the 21st century, the term witch still conjures up wicked images for many people. People who have childhood memories of the Wizard of Oz tend not to recall that there was a good witch and a bad witch in the movie. They just remember maybe the more compelling archetype of the bad witch. But I do think that's changing. You know, I find myself today, I tell my own kids, who are two boys aged 6 and 9, that the term witch should never be used as an epithet, that there are people for whom that's a very real religious commitment, and the lives that they lead and the way that they conduct themselves and the tone that they take are often impeccable. So I actually think in the present generation, we're going to see.
Let's see what happened to Mitch. We're looking That's it. You're there, Mitch? Okay. Mitch?
Sorry. Yeah, still here.
Okay. Sorry we lost you there for a second.
No problem.
Okay. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying that the meaning that we bring to words, especially a malevolent meaning, tends to linger for a long, long time. But I do think in the present generation, we're going to see some of the edge come off the word witch. It's inevitable, especially because the community in this country that actually practices witchcraft and Wicca, which is easily accessible online through hundreds of websites, takes a tone that's actually very impeccable and responsible. And I, as a parent, have been encouraging my kids never to hear that word or use that word as some sort of an epithet.
All right. Lisa, thanks a lot for your call. So what about witches as glamorous beings? I'm wondering, like, there's a lot of different connotation when you say sorceress.
Yes. Yeah.
Than when you say witch.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of the popularity of Wicca and a lot of the popularity of the books and the literature today that deal with spell casting and different forms of nature worship is attributable to readers very often who are female, who are teenaged, who are in their early 20s. They experience Wicca and witchcraft as a kind of empowering practice. It's independent. It's something that gives people a sense that they can bring their personal will out into the world, but it also provides a kind of religious and ethical framing that says the point of life is not just to do to others whatever you wish, but that we're all part of some circle. So there's a sacred, ethical, but also empowering quality in a lot of the contemporary New Age literature that deals with Wicca and covens and spell casting. And that literature circulates among chiefly among female readers, though not exclusively, and you have a lot of teenage girls who are imbibing that literature. For them, there's an empowering quality to all this. There's an independent quality to all this. It's a form of rebellion that doesn't take people in a kind of nihilistic direction, but takes them in a direction of experimentation with a belief system that still seems a little forbidden, that still seems a little verboten and off to the fringes. But this really hasn't changed since the 1950s. You often find female practitioners of Wicca, sometimes quite young, who feel that there's something personally very independent and empowering about it.
And there's something very threatening culturally in our
yes.
country about a powerful woman.
There is indeed, and I think that, you know, we see patterns of rebellion in our country where people get tired of having labels thrown at them, like witch, and instead of running from the labels, they start to embrace the labels and say, look, you know, if you're going to call me that, I'll embrace it, and I'll show you what it is, you know? And I think we very often find that in our country. You know, people will take these labels that in one generation are used as epithets, in another generation they'll claim them, and they'll claim them proudly.
Where did the pointy hat come from?
Nah.
Where did that whole
conical hat.
the whole image come
yeah.
from? I mean, should we, you know, blame Frank L. Baum for that?
No, I don't think we can blame Frank Baum for that. He was a person who was actually a real religious experimenter himself. Mm-hmm. Frank Baum was interested in different occult and mystical and positive thinking philosophies. He was quite an experimenter himself. You started to see that in drawings. There are late Renaissance era woodcuts of witches, sometimes in books that are dedicated to the persecution of witches. But you'll find woodcuts and drawings from the late Renaissance that start to depict the witch as the old crone in the hat, and that's where that piece of source material got picked up and repeated throughout the culture.
And there are a lot of bad ladies in Grimm's fairy tales and so forth, and
yeah.
they're just bad people, but we look back on them and refer to them as the witch in Hansel and Gretel.
We do indeed, and what's interesting is, you know, if you ask teenagers across this country, have they read Hansel and Gretel, although they probably have some familiarity with it because it's such an archetype,
mm-hmm.
Almost to a person they would say no. And the mirror reverse is true with their reading of Harry Potter. You know, the younger generation, they've read Harry Potter. They haven't read Grimm's fairy tales. And we're going to start to feel that effect.
Okay. Well, Mitch Horowitz, I want to thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann. Glad to be here.
Mitch Horowitz, he's vice president and editor-in-chief at Tarcher Penguin. It's the division of Penguin Books dedicated to metaphysical literature. He's the author of Occult America. That's why he's been on the show in the past. And today, his new book, One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life, is forthcoming from Crown in January 2014. And I'm looking forward to talking with you about that, Mitch.
Same here. Thank you.
Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Kiram Shaban, Shannon Clary, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and senior broadcast technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me, Ann, on Twitter too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of Ohio State University.
Support comes from Wexner Heritage Village, home of geriatric planning solutions. Now there's a GPS for families navigating the complex and changing landscape of senior health care. More on Wexner Heritage Village's geriatric planning solutions at whv.org.